I thought that today I would try to present the discoveries of mythological relevance to contemporary circumstance of two of the greatest creative minds of the present century, namely Thomas Mann and James Joyce. I regard these as sort of matched heroes. Thomas Mann, proceeding from a Protestant base, and James Joyce from the Roman Catholic, moved into the problems of the contemporary world in parallel courses. Neither, as far as I know, conscious during the greater part of his work life of the doings of the other. And yet, in an extremely interesting way, their paths moved along step by step, two different paths, but at the same pace. The first works of each were in the style of the 19th century naturalistic novel, and are autobiographical in content. The Buddenbrooks of Thomas Mann, and Tonio Krieger of Thomas Mann. Buddenbrooks are a great two-volume family saga, and Tonio, the story of a dislocated youth finding his art style and life form. These works appeared respectively in 1903 and 1904. It's just about that time that Joyce was working on the first drafts of what later became the Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man. And one version of these drafts has been published as Stephen Hero. The Portrait came out in 1916. Then follows the First World War, after which there appeared the two great monuments of the first half of the present century. Joyce's Ulysses in, I think it was 1921, 22, and Thomas Mann's Magic Mountain in 1924, in relation to which T.S. Eliot's Wasteland appeared. The remarkable thing is that exactly the same mythological motifs appear in all three of these works, and all three culminate in a shock experience, which is associated with a thunderclap. I want to speak of these at some length. Proceeding from the naturalistic novel base, in both of these, in all of these works just following the war, one finds the artist bringing into discourse the mythological associations which underlie his composition. The works are only apparently naturalistic. They are actually mythological adventures that are rendered through contemporary lives. And then, finally, in the 30s, both men slip right down into the mythological realm. Thomas Mann, in his Joseph novels, the great tetralogy of Joseph and his brothers, and James Joyce in Finnegan's Wake. Now, I'm not going to try to say anything about the Joseph novels and Finnegan's Wake, because that's a year's course, a 2 years course in itself. But I do propose to use these earlier works, the particularly Tonio Krieger, the Portrait, the Magic Mountain, and Ulysses, as my media for this communication today. The Tonio Krieger is the story of a young man from northern Germany whose father is the normal blue-eyed blonde of that community, but whose mother is a dark-haired, dark-eyed person of Mediterranean provenance. And so the young man has dark hair and dark eyes and is an exceptional member of his community. He's exceptional also in that his temperament has some of the heat of the Mediterranean burning in it, and this separates him in his reactions from the others. So you have the picture of the isolated one, the one who feels himself to be the outsider, the observer. And his fields of concern and interest as an outsider tend to be meditative, literary, brooding, and so forth. He loves to read Schiller, and particularly Don Carlos, the excluded, strange little prince, and so falls away. He cannot participate in what we today would call, perhaps, the activities of the establishment. So that when he comes into adolescence, he moves to the Mediterranean. That is to say, he has come to be a, what today would be, a wanderer, perhaps in the hippie environment. And in those days, there were hippies too, and these were called the Bohemians, and he finds himself with these. And in the world of the Bohemians is this Russian girl, Lizaveta, who is, like all intellectuals, extremely disdainful of the establishment and its inhabitants. However, when he had been a younger youth in the blonde environment, he had great admiration and joy in looking at the handsome, competent, blue-eyed blondes, particularly one little couple, and the girl's name was Ingeborg, and he devoted his heart to her. When he would go to dancing class, however, she never understood the inquietude and depths of his nature, and the girls who did understand him were the ones who fell down when they danced. So this business of being in this curious relationship to the female, as I say, made him ready to understand Lizaveta, who never danced in her life. And she, as the Russian, represented the non-European world, and in Thomas Mann, the Russians, she comes up again in The Magic Mountain, the Russian girl, stands for Asia, which for the European is the loosening of all culture forms. The world of Asia, and Russia is Asia, is a world of totally different mentality and form structure. And so when you move from this to that, you're in a world which has its own structures, but as far as your structures are concerned, they dissolve. So we get the sense of going into the great vast ocean here. Well, now the point that I wish to bring up, and is the occasion for my talking about Mann's Tonio Krüger, is this. He had given his heart to Ingeborg, to the blue-eyed, beautiful world. And nevertheless, they did not meet his spiritual, mental, emotional requirements. When he went into the Bohemian realm, he found people who could discourse with him intellectually. But their attitude toward the establishment was one that he could not share. They had no heart for it. They had no compassion for it. They had no sympathy for it. Their whole approach was critical, and they were very apt with their words. They were very keen with their observation in detecting faults. Now, this brings us to this basic point, which Mann brings up in this this really remarkable work. By the way, both Buddenbrooks and Tonio came out before Thomas Mann was 25 years old. He wrote, these are his youth works. when you use words to describe, you have to point to and name the distinguishing characteristics. The distinguishing characteristics of anyone are his faults. So that in describing a person, what you are describing are those irregularities which distinguish him from the norm. And you can be quite cruel this way. The word kills. Now, Tonio was unable to be satisfied in the world of the establishment, but this absolutely critical, hostile, antagonistic attitude which made these verbal barbs so sharp was one that he could not share either, although his eye and his verbal facilities and his critical facilities were as strong as anyone else's. And so he found himself neither able to participate in the establishment nor able to sympathize with the attitudes of the critical group, the intellectuals, so-called. And so he said he found himself between two worlds, between the two poles. This forced him to a transcendent synthesis of his own, some way of experiencing that would be adequate to his two sentiments, the sentiment of affection for the world in its health, and the sentiment of participation in the critical attitude of those who saw that health as inferior to the possibilities. Now Nietzsche, who was Thomas Mann's guiding guru, you might say, in his youth, had already spoken of the mystery of disease and health. Thinking is a function of disease. When you think about your stomach, when it aches, the principal advances in our sciences have come by way of medicine, you might say, which deals with what's wrong with people. And so Nietzsche associated thinking with disease, with the decadence. It's when a culture begins to think about itself that it's on the way down. The culture on the way up is spontaneous. The life unfolds as it does in children and so forth. But it's when the aches and pains begin to come that you begin to think about them. And for Nietzsche, of course, Socrates represented the beginning of the decadence in the classical tradition. He began going around asking people about things which they've been taking for granted, and when you ask people about things like that, they begin to worry about them, and even love becomes a problem, marriage becomes a problem. It's the period of problems instead of simply doing things. So we have Nietzsche speaking about these two poles, health and sickness. He spoke of going from the sphere of health through the sphere of sickness to a higher health. His idea of the Superman is one who has a margin of health around the maximum amount of sickness that that margin can contain. It's quite different from the idea of the master man that people usually associate with Nietzsche. His Superman is one who contains the two, but where sickness does not overthrow health, but rather is in its service, in the service of life, not in the dismemberment of life. It's out of that that Tonio Kruger comes to his solution, and I want to give this as a key to Thomas Mann's art. It is the key, it is the solution that he names erotic irony, plastic irony. You regard with the keenest eye you can, and I had the privilege of meeting Thomas Mann and being with him for rather a while, and you always feel that this man is reading you right through without very much kindness in his eye. He's really looking right through and finding the words, registering you, and some detail of your character may turn up in one of his works later on in rather a way. But at the same time, with his heart, there is compassion, there is sympathy, there is love. And he uses the image of the arrow sent from the mind, the keen arrow with the balm of compassion on the point, so that though it digs in, it nevertheless carries the healing at the same time. This is the plastic irony, and we come to a next point. What is lovable about a person is his faults. Perfection is not lovable. It is admirable, perhaps. One can look at it and admire, but where is love? when a little toddler comes fumbling and tumbling along, it's the disproportion of the whole thing that's utterly lovable. As I was coming here, I saw two kittens, absolutely black, one sitting on the top of a little post and the other at the bottom of it. It was a ridiculous scene, but it was perfectly lovable, these two funny little faces there. There's an absurd dog sits outside of my place with the strangest ears. It looks like something that came out of the Spook Sonata. And it's a lovable beast. And so we come to this curious, ironic point that the fault of the person is what must be loved. And furthermore, you know Paul's word, love beareth all things. And the majesty and dimension of your love is the measure of how many faults you can detect with love in the world, in your neighbor, and so on. I'll say this for Thomas Mann. He identified himself with Tonio Krieger, and Tonio was himself, and with the principle of love, going along with the principle of critical accuracy and ruthlessness. However, when his blue-eyed blondes turned out to be the hordes of Hitler, his ability to incorporate this in his love broke up, and at that moment his art broke up also. This is a very important thing. When the artist's formula is that of which Thomas Mann made his life, namely erotic irony, where the love factor cracks, you get into something else besides the kind of art that Thomas Mann was talking about. You get into propaganda, which is another thing. So erotic irony became his clue. It is the key to his aesthetic. It is light and dark, and you can't depict anything without those two tones, yang and yin, light and dark. So much then for the guiding formula of Mann's art. Also, out of this, I think we get the story of a mythological voyage from the world, in the world of light and achievement, into the abyss, the underworld, where he comes to Lizaveta and has these discussions with her, and then the departure from Lizaveta and the quest for a way back to the world from which he came and a way to communicate with it. And it's that in Mann's life of erotic irony. That is to be the vehicle of his pedagogy, and it becomes the system of his art. Now, when we move from the Tonio to the Magic Mountain, we have a vast presentation, and I would advise anybody who is asking himself, what is the modern myth? How does one deal with modern human beings' experiences in the way of recognizing in these mythological overtones and guidances, to read the Magic Mountain again, if you have already read it, and for the first time if you haven't had this marvelous experience. The story, very briefly, I'm going to outline only the very briefest part of it because it's an enormous thing to discourse upon. The story is simply of a young man brought up in northern Germany again, Hans Castorp, as Thomas Mann says, a simple young man, who moved automatically into his life career. He was a competent student in engineering, and he became a marine engineer, and he got his job with perfect ease, and he belonged to a Bürger family of North Germany, and so there were certain distinctions and prestige, and of course you can get the job because you know everybody and so forth. He just moved right in. But then his health began to fail. He was not enthusiastic. His whole spirit was not in this. And the doctor, his family doctor, advised him to get away from it and just take rest for a couple of weeks. A total change was what he needed. Many people have had this advice from their doctor. Well, what would the total change be? Nothing better for a person brought up in northern Germany, which is a rather flat land, and Mann uses this term, the flat land, to describe the world of the establishment. There's nothing better than to go to the mountains. So they say, why don't you go to Switzerland? Well, look, you have a cousin there, Joachim Simpson, who has TB. He is a military man. He moved into the army. He fell sick also with TB and went to Davos in Switzerland, a perfectly beautiful ski resort where there are tuberculosis sanitariums. Just go pay him a visit and enjoy the experience there. Fine. So he packs up, and as he starts up the mountain, he begins to experience a total transformation of the spirit relevant to the total transformation of the landscape. Now we're in mythological realms. We're going beyond, we're going into that realm of adventure. What is the transformation that he sees? He sees, of course, mountain heights and these wonderful Swiss trains going on up. It's a grand, thrilling experience. But he notices also that the deciduous trees, the trees that put on and lose their leaves and represent the cycle of time, are giving way to evergreens, trees that do not suggest the cycle of time, but a kind of timelessness. And the snow-capped peaks, which are, as he says, the eternal snows, the everlasting snows, which are also eloquent of timelessness. And then the air changes, it thins out, and his breathing gets faster. This is a pranayama, the breath control, automatically faster, and with that, his heartbeat steps up, and he begins to be excited about something. He doesn't know what he's excited about. It's the kind of emotion you would have if you were falling in love, but what's the love object? There's nothing there. So here he goes out of the realm of time, which is the realm of the life of the world, which even here in Esalen, not too far away from the life of the world, we feel slip away. You haven't seen a newspaper. I don't know what's been going on since I've been here. This is a totally different, as Thomas Mann says, hermetically sealed retort, sealed away from the life of the world. He goes up there to eternity, where one day or one month or one year or whatnot, all the same, no events, just the same thing over and over, and he's excited. Well, when he gets out at the top and is met by his cousin, Joachim, he sees this sun-tanned youth, the magnificent young military physique. The boy is dying inside. He has a lung crumbling away, and it's only an appearance of health with sickness beneath. And Hans is so excited about everything that he's giggling and laughing and he's out of all control. He's in a state of ecstasy simply because of the rarity of the air. Next thing he notices is that there's death all around him. And death is taken for granted. And the dead on the who die in the sanitarium, everybody's expected to die, this is the land of the dead. He has gone into the land of the dead. The dead are sent down the hill on bobsleds. Well, this seems irreverence to death. He had had a very reverent feeling toward death. The transformer is, in the first place now, the Lord Death. He is in the realm of the Lord Death. He's going to learn something about death. But he's also excited in a rather strange way, and he finds that the thing that the people are really interested in up there, who have no place to go, nothing to do, don't know how long they're going to be there, is philandering. As he says, temperature and temperature. So the thing is a little bit dissolute from the point of view of the place he has come from. His second educator then is going to be Venus, the goddess of lust. Death and lust. Do you remember the name of the tempter who tempted the Buddha? Exactly that, Kama Mara, lust and death. So he's in the realm of the Lord of life, who is the Lord of death, and there it goes. Now he's assigned to a room. The room is number 34, which is number 7. And I'll tell you that he's going to stay there. He's going to get TB. He's going to, because he wants it, for 7 years. And when he takes his temperature, he takes it for 7 minutes. He's in the magic mountain where these symbolic things are in every aspect of the environment. Well, not to repeat the story because this would be absurd, but there are two sort of shipwrecked pedagogues up there. Settembrini, who represents the attitude of what used to be called liberals, namely liberals, and other man, Nafta, who is a Jew who became a Jesuit and is in political ideology a communist. These three represent the Levantine tradition of social authoritarianism, not the liberal tradition, but the you do it this way or get eliminated tradition. The medieval dogmatism of the church against the liberal. Well, these two pedagogues are in continuous argument. They're word men. Talking. One favoring, well, one would favor, for example, that a woman giving birth to a child who is having such difficulty that she can't give birth to the child without dying should be allowed to die and give birth to the child. This would be the church's standpoint. The standpoint of Settembrini would be that it should be the child who died and the mother who lived. There's as opposite in everything as in that argument, these two stand against each other. But as Thomas Mann points out during the course of the book, finally, both of them are in totally illogical positions because they're simply verbal and conceptually based, and their positions cross as you go through the book. So Hans is between these, listening to these arguments. Settembrini, the humanist, says, get back to the world. You owe it to your society, just as the Lord Dharma said to the Buddha. Get back to the world, and none of this philandering with lust and all this kind of thing. However, there is a Russian woman there whose name is Klavdia, and she has dirty fingernails, and she slams the door. She's an irritating type, and she has that erotic charm of a person who is just a bit diseased, and he is absolutely fascinated by her, as he is with the whole environment, and he sort of wants to be there, and the culminating moment at the end of the first half of the book is when, in a kind of Saturnalian adventure at Mardi Gras time, they're playing a game of drawing a pig without blindfolded. And to draw the pig, he borrows a pencil from Klavdia, and this is the first time he's spoken to her. And what's this pig business? You suddenly realize this is Circe. This is Circe's realm. It's Circe who showed Odysseus the underworld. And Mann's letting these things play in this way, these mythological adventures. Well, one of the great crises in his illumination was when he saw his own hand through a fluoroscope and saw his own grave there, his own skeleton, his own death, which would remain, and he realized that death is part of life and so forth. And so then he asks the doctor, well, what's the difference between life and death? Well, says the doctor, decay is oxidation and life is oxidation. So Stephen Hans thinks, well, they're the same thing. No, says the doctor. Life is oxidation that holds its form. And so this form principle comes in. Now, these are two themes that develop the idea of the hermetic retort in which you are isolated, and the idea of the discovery, finally, after disintegration, of the principle of form. I just want to say a word about the hermetic retort. Hermes is the god who guides souls through the underworld of death to the wisdom and experience of rebirth from health or life through sickness or death to the higher health or strong rebirth. Let us say this is a hermetic retort, or a sealed can of peaches. Those peaches are removed from time. As long as that can lasts hermetically sealed, they will be there. Time will pass, the people who tinned it will be gone, even the civilization may be gone, and some archaeologist from the year 9010 will be digging somewhere and a can of peaches, open them up, there they are, fresh and blooming and lovely, etc. When you are in this center here, you are removed from time. Now most of us, when we are brought up, or when we go to school, and particularly in this present period when it's thought that the campus should be alert to what's going on in the world, we are responding to stimuli. You have a stimulus and you have a response. This is the year for, let's say, protesting against such and such, so you protest too. You're always doing what the environment is causing you to do. Suppose you could shut yourself off from that and these no longer touched you, then you wouldn't have these responses. You'd be sinking into your own center, and gradually by moving toward it, and this is what Hans is doing in the Magic Mountain, you find your own center, and then after that you act from your own center. This is reaction, and that's the way most people live. This is action. And you can't act till you've found your own center. Until that has happened, you are simply the agent of someone else's action. The one who agitates you. The one who gives you the theme on which to work. The guru, the leader, the whatever. And this, of course, is what both Serembrini and Naphta represented. Authorities who said, you do the way I say to do it. Hans pulled away from that. He let his fascination, that's the key to your adventure. Where your true fascination is, there's your adventure. And there was danger there. His lungs and everything. Death was approaching him, and he was risking it. It was worth it. The life that's worth living is the one that's worth risking death for. And in that way he found what his own center was. Now Mount throughout this is parodying in a way Goethe's Faust. I don't imagine many of you here have read Goethe's Faust, so I'm not going to annoy you with a recitation of that also. But in Goethe's Faust there is a wonderful scene of the witch's kitchen, where Faust sees in the mirror the image of woman, and this lures him forward. Hans at one point breaks away from Serembrini, the man who tells him go down in the world and behave as a modern person should, with duties. And he goes to the doctor's office, Dr. Behrens, the one who had shown him his hand through the fluoroscope. And in Behrens' office, there is a picture of this woman, Klavdia, that Behrens, the doctor, had painted. He's something of a dilettante in the painting world also. And Hans looks at the picture, and there's something particularly erotically stimulating about the skin. And Behrens says, well, it does help, you to know something about what's under the skin. And Hans thinks, oh, to know what's under Klavdia's skin. So he begins to study science. He becomes interested in science as, you might say, a revelation of the miracle of Klavdia. And he goes from one science to another, and the science of the universe. The whole universe then becomes for him an exposition of the wonder of Klavdia. Here is that image that I showed you at the end of the tarot pack of the woman as world, and the woman is his world. And at the end of this pig drawing party, he does go to Clavdia, and it is very discreetly represented, but he kneels before her and describes in the most absurd love making that has ever been rendered. He describes to her in bad French, or rather German French, her body in its sort of biological character, where the lymph glands are and all that. And she sits there with compassion receiving this, and he finally just drops his head in her lap, and she strokes his head and said, you funny little German boy, you know. But he finally comes, and you find in the next chapter that he has in his pocket an x-ray picture of Clavdia's lungs. He has won his prize. Well, he remains on the mountain, becoming acquainted with all of the depths and mysteries of being and of thinking and everything else for 7 years. Finally, there comes to the mountain a great Dutch merchant from Dutch Indonesia. And this is a remarkable man. He is all personality. He cannot complete a sentence. He's delightful to listen to, but you have no idea what he's saying. And it's just worthwhile watching him do it. This is a person. I remember Bourdelle, the great French sculptor, saying once in his studio in France, it is the personality that counts, not the words. The words here in this wonderful man, whose name is Papercorn, Herr Papercorn, words for him are expressions of the personality, whereas for Settembrini and Naphta, they were the whole life. Well, the climax of Hans's experience of these people is at a party that Papercorn stages. And this is a wonderful symbolic party. He gets Settembrini and some other people and Naphta together, and Clavdia and all, and Hans, and they go out for a picnic. And the place he chooses for the picnic is at the foot of one of these terrific Swiss waterfalls that's making so much noise you can't hear a thing. So these two verbal experts are absolutely wiped out, and their personalities are obviously not worth considering. And they can't talk, so they're not even there. Nobody looks at them. What does the party do? The party goes up in awe to the phenomenon of the waterfall. And they start moving their lips and saying, nobody can hear what anyone's saying, but it's worth doing that. Just letting the world sympathize with your sympathy with the waterfall. And then they walk up once, here's the waterfall coming down like this. There's a little path goes up here, and there's a tiny little bridge that goes across, and then they come down again. The circle. That's a trip that goes nowhere. You are acting here not in order to get anything done, but just to enjoy the act. This is the secret of life, according to Mann's presentation. It's not to get anywhere. You're not saying anything to communicate anything. It's just, you know, the expression, the bloom, the flowering of something. And all these silly people walk up, and when they get here, they look over and they wave to each other, just the how do you do, and aren't we having fun enjoying this boom of the waterfall. They come back, and the climax comes when Papercorn stands up to make a speech. And he does make a speech. Everyone's fascinated and straining to get it. Nobody hears a word. Then they pack up and they come home. This is the kind of the, I always think of it as the Zen image in Thomas Mann. The wonder, the mystery of silence, but the silence producing its forms, and they're just there, as the Buddhists say, Tathagata, thus come. There's no meaning. It's only their being that we behold. Okay, we've sort of had our discovery of the center, which is being, and not all these meanings and doings. doing can come out of the being. And just about the time Hans has got this message, there comes the thunderclap that breaks the hermetic container. The bugle of World War I. Now Hans is in Switzerland. He doesn't have to go to war. During that time, many people were trying to get to Switzerland to get out of the war. But Hans now is competent for life. And he voluntarily goes down into the war on the opposite side from that which Serembini would have liked to have seen him join. He joined, as Thomas Mann says, there where blood called, not ideas. He went into the German army. And the last scene is Hans in the trenches. That is Mann's counterpart of the message of the Bhagavad Gita that I spoke of before. The entry into life. At its worst, look at this. In a simple job, a fine job, he was bored. He was unable to stand it. He goes here, he finds his own center, his own competence, his own love, competent to absorb anything the world can give in its nastiness, in its filth, in its horror, and able to take that, he goes right down and engages in that horrendous thing of the trench warfare of World War I. That's the Magic Mountain. There is an adventure. There is the mythological themes. And Thomas Mann, in that work, and I do suggest you read it, he associates every single event, and he tells you what the association is, with a mythological character. And you can see that by analogy with your own life, see by that the operation of these mythological archetypes in your own living. So much then for the Protestant. He comes from the naturalistic tradition, practically ignorant of mythological forms, and he discovers the play of mythological forms in the sphere of time. James Joyce comes from the opposite direction. Brought up as a Catholic, he is, in his childhood, introduced to mythological forms. When you go into a Catholic household, you'll see on the walls and the pictures of the Virgin, the Madonna, Christ, angels, saints, St. George and the dragon and all that, you're brought up with these mythological images. And the problem of a Catholic is when he goes out into the world to see the relevance of these images to the actualities of life in time. You've been brought up, so to say, in aeviternity, in that realm of images which are timeless, and to see them operative in time is the problem. Whereas with Thomas Mann, it works the other way. He's brought up in the Protestant world. When you go into a Protestant household, you don't see archetypal images on the walls. You see portraits of ancestors, of dogs and cats and favorite horses and things like that, landscapes that people want to enjoy. You see the phenomenology of temporal life. And so Mann goes from those into the realm of mythological images. Joyce goes in the opposite direction. Well, to speak then briefly of Joyce's adventure, the counterpart of Mann's, which I've just described, Stephen Dedalus, in the portrait, has been devoting himself and has been forced to devote himself to the understanding and association of his life with those of the images. But his domestic life deteriorates. The family becomes rather poor, but also he finds it rather gross and vulgar. There are scenes at home that repel him. So he drops off the family scene. He goes to school. He's the one who falls down when he tries to carry the ball. He isn't getting on like the little girls who fall down when they dance. He's the one who falls down when he tries to hit somebody. But he's a plucky kid. And the school seems cold and all that. So then he turns from school to whoring. He goes into the brothels and is rather precocious youth there. And I can imagine the girls think he was rather cute and all. And he's enjoying all that very thoroughly when there comes the annual school retreat. I don't know how many of you have ever attended a Roman Catholic retreat conducted by a Jesuit, but believe me, the Sermon on Hell is enough to turn you over. And it did turn him over. What Joyce has done in presenting that Sermon on Hell is to present the whole job in such a way that you get it while reading it. And this little boy who's been doing hellish things is given to see what a foul, miserable, dirty life he's been living in contrast with the potentiality of his spirit. And he is dissociated from it violently. He's become sick and everything else. This makes him want to be a saint because he always wants to be the best. So he has thrown off the family, the school, the brothels. Now he's going to be a saint. The priests who are teaching him think, well, Stephen looks like one who might have a vocation. So they talk to him about it and ask him if he wouldn't like to be a priest, and just think of the noble career of the priest, bringing Christ himself on the altar into the world. And Stephen begins to recognize that everything the priests say is somehow cliché. They haven't had the experiences they're talking about. This is the priestly mentality. They criticize books they haven't read, and so forth and so on, and they drop off. So now he's at an impasse. And in that condition of not knowing what to do, he's out walking on the shore, and there's a little inlet, and he looks and sees a girl wading in the stream with her skirts kilted up. And she is like a strange crane or seabird there. Now, the erotic relationship is broken. What he sees is a thing of beauty, and he is not tempted to it, nor repelled from it, but simply stabilized in the contemplation of this beautiful phenomenon, and she notices his gaze and turns and looks at him without coyness or shyness, just looking. And this eternal moment breaks when she finally just turns away a little and stirs the water with her feet, and he turns away and thinks, the angel of the world has called me, and I now know my career. This was the revelation. His career was to be the celebration of that moment. After he has had this experience, his first job is to formulate an aesthetic theory. And it's with a review of that I want to conclude my morning talk. Thomas Mann's theory was based on the principle of erotic irony, as I explained it. The relation of two people to each other, the critical and the loving together. Joyce's is based on a moment of stabilization. Joyce's theory of aesthetics as follows is that the most important, clean, succinct theory of art that has been presented, and it was presented by James Joyce, and this is the theory that stood up all through Ulysses and through Finnegan's Wake, and is the theory of the master writer of the century. He distinguishes between proper and improper art. Now, proper simply means art serving the function that is proper to art. Improper means art in the service of some other aim than that proper to art. Proper art he calls static. You remember the moment when he saw the girl was a static moment, aesthetic arrest. Improper art he calls kinetic. That means movement. What is to be moved, or what is moved by improper art, is the observer. The observer is moved either by desire for the object depicted or by loathing for it. A critical work is intended to make you loathe the society depicted. Works exciting desire, Joyce calls pornographic. Pornography is art that invokes your desire for the object depicted. That's the definition in Joyce's terminology. Works devoted to this situation and asking you to desire another, he calls didactic. They're teaching you something. Now we come to the definition of the crisis of the aesthetic stasis. Joyce takes his terms here from Thomas Aquinas. The aesthetic experience has three qualities. They are integritas, consonantia, and claritas. Integritas means wholeness. Consonantia means harmony. Claritas means radiance. And one can take any cluster of objects. Let's just take what's around me right here. We can take part of the, well, how can I do it? This little arrangement on the floor here. Just the tape recorder and this mic and that little element there and the lower part of this stand. Let's put a frame around that and say now this little framed area and its contents are to be regarded as one object. The rest of this stand is other. The rest of the floor is other. What is within the frame is one object. Now when that occurs, you have something that you've never seen before. Don't try to identify the different contents of this. Think of the whole thing as one object with these as elements of the object. That's the integritas. What is to be framed in the picture is to be regarded as one thing, not a picture of an assortment of things, but one thing in itself. Such a thing as never was before. Now, when that is the case, what becomes important is the relationship of part to part, part to the whole, and the whole to each of the parts, whether this is here or here, getting the balance. And when the balance is fortunate, we are fascinated by it. What Joyce calls the rhythm of beauty is the vehicle of art. When the harmony, the balance, the relationship is perfectly, fortunately achieved, then that object is fascinating, and that is the claritas or radiance, and you don't ask, what is it for? What service can it render? The service is being rendered. The service is its fascination. Now, as I've said, fascination is the lure to the Hermetic pedagogy. And here, any object fascinating you can hold you and evoke your whole spirit. And you don't ask, what's it for? It's simply, again, tathagata, thus come. And Joyce says, then you see that it is that object which it is and no other thing. It is radiating its beauty. That is the rhythm of beauty. This is the enchantment of the heart, which is the aim of art. And it throws you into the same spiritual state that the Buddha is supposed to throw you into. You go through that gate, you remember, with the two cherubim, one representing desire, the other representing aggression or loathing. And there's the bo tree with the Tathagata, the one that's come. You put aside, in observing the object, desire and loathing, as Stephen did when he saw the girl, and the revelation comes, the Tathagata, thus come, the Buddha thing. Well, that's easy to say when you're talking about abstract art, but suppose you have a play with people in it, or suppose you have a picture with desirable things. What can you do to hold this stasis under those circumstances? He comes then to the problem of the tragic and comic emotions. These are the emotions that must be evoked and called to you. Turning now to Aristotle, we find that the tragic emotions are pity and terror. The comic emotion is joy. Now, pity and terror. Stephen, this arrogant youth, says, Aristotle has not defined them, I have. The definitions are as follows. Pity is that emotion which arrests the mind before whatsoever is grave and constant in human suffering. The emotion that arrests the mind before whatsoever is grave and constant in human suffering and unites it, that's the compassion thing, with the human sufferer. You are united with the human sufferer, not the sufferer who is, let us say, a Frenchman, a German, a resistor, a Negro, a Japanese, or what? The human sufferer. And if you can't show the human being through the local definition, you're not at work right. Also, grave and constant. That which cannot be changed. You are not being invited to change anything. You are being invited to take to feel compassion for what is in being and the way it is. What is terror? Terror is the emotion that arrests the mind before whatsoever is grave and constant in human suffering and unites it with the secret cause. What is the secret cause of so-and-so's death? One could take a number of dramatic deaths that have recently occurred, the death of one or another of the two Kennedy brothers, the death of Martin Luther King. These deaths can be dealt with in desire and loathing forms, in the way of didactic and propaganda. But how do you deal with them tragically? A shoots B. Well, let's take the Martin Luther King, because that's an easy one. A is a white man of a certain kind. B is a black man of a certain kind. What is the cause? Is it the hatred of white for black? Well, let's say so. What is the cause? Is it the bullet? Well, let's say so. Those aren't secret causes at all. Those are instrumental causes. Those are temporal causes. Those can be changed. Well, what is the grave and constant thing there? So that this becomes a revelation of the preconditions and actualities of all life everywhere. Well, look for it. Bring it out. With affirmation. Not with the sense that this should not have been, but with the sense of the glory of this, at the same time with the sympathy for the human sufferer, so that you have this, you're getting what I'm getting, the plastic irony again. There is the terror of the cause. What is the cause? Mortality. We all must die. You can't change that. One man's death comes to him this way, another comes that way. And there's also the majesty of the destiny of the one who is the killer of the other, Jesus and Judas. They were built that way. That's the way the world works, in the way of the coming and going of the pairs of opposites. I was working before coming here on the mythologies and rites of the Mayan and Aztec Indians. And they regard the world as inevitably in duality. It shows itself in dualities. And these dualities are the wonder and marvel of the world. Now the duality that is stressed in the Hindu tradition is the male-female duality. The duality that's stressed in the Maya Aztec tradition is the duality of contending antagonists. And their thesis is, what brings the opposites together is battle. That is the creative medium of all life, according to this view. And battle gives you a marvelous image of the inevitability of duality and yet the transcendence of it. Because in every battle, there is loss and victory. One is the loser, the other is the winner. But the main thing is that coming together. This is a tragic view. It is represented with affirmation. War is called the flowery war. It is that by which life flowers. And of course the flowering of sacrifice in that war, in that world, is absolutely horrendous. But these sacrifices were rendered as emblems, as flowers to the gods, to the goddesses, who have given of their lives for us. The whole thing is the giving of a life. And then the majesty, well, let us think of the Martin Luther King and the flowering that comes out of that, which would not have come had that not happened, is something you might wish to show. But that would be only secondary to the focal representation of the miracle of death in life and the death that comes to the one who has given himself to life all the way. The death of someone who has not given himself all the way is rather insignificant, but here is a jewel death, so to say, and it is best rendered that way, not as propaganda, but as a flower. Well then, those are the two tragic emotions. You behold with horror, experience with horror, the secret cause which is operating in all of us now. Our deaths are being born in us. And at the same time, you affirm it. This is the tragic view. You get it in the Greeks. You won't get it in other cultures so strongly. Because, for instance, in the Orient, you can't have a tragedy. When you have reincarnation, you can't have a tragic death. I'll never forget a great film, great in length, that was produced by Shankar some years ago. I forgot what the name of it was. I think it was Kalpa or something like that. And it showed the life and death of a number of people. And they would work up, you would work up toward the tragic thing, you know, and you're all excited and, gosh, I hope he doesn't die. Well, he dies. And within one movie frame, he's in another life. And that other one's wiped out. You don't even have a moment to absorb what's happened because we are, in the Orient, the hero is not the individual. As they say in the Gita, the body is put on and put off, as clothes are put on and put off. The hero in the Indian system is the so-called jiva, the reincarnating monad which puts bodies on and puts them off. Whereas in our world, we are interested in the body that is put on and put off, and that's where the tragedy is. And you don't throw it away. Job said to God, "What is man that thou shouldst regard him?" Okay, you throw man away. In the Orient, in the deeper Orient, the body is put on and put off, you throw it away. Not with the Greeks, not with the European. That body is what you're affirming. You know it's going to be thrown away. And the marvel of it is this moment, which cannot return, which will not endure, and yet in a certain sense is an eternal moment. That's what's got to come up here. And with that, you have joy at the same time. Joy is not desire. It is not loathing. It is not wishing for something. It is not avoiding something. It's having it. And you have it in the tragedy itself. And so the highest art form, I would say, in our world is the tragic comedy, where with that smash, there comes the joy in it. That's what you get in Greek. I'll never forget a Greek rendition of Oedipus that I saw when the horror of that final scene, you know, the Greeks really put on a show, the eyes bleeding and all this business, you were simply appalled. You have the whole thing sort of wiped out. The chorus, which had been facing backstage, been facing upstage, suddenly turned around, and God, the radiance came out. This is the show of the marvel of the being of existence, in which death is part of the seed. Well, these then are the two art approaches of Mann and Joyce. Joyce stressing that eternal, grave and constant, eternal, unchanging thing, which is the world of the mythological forms. And Mann stressing the timely presence for which you feel criticism and love at the same time. One stressing the person-to-person relationship, the other stressing the underlying eternal presence that shows itself through these. So much then for the little presentation I intended of two authors who can introduce you, and not only introduce you, but carry you a long way into the understanding of it, the play of these archetypes, the grave and constant. Mythology is the, might say, anthology of the grave and constant. Through the myths, the grave and constant is shown in symbolic forms. And by recognizing these, you recognize what you have to affirm if you're going to live. And if you decide not to affirm them, well, there's a grave and constant way to do that too. And turn to the Jains, and turn to the Buddhists, and so forth, and they'll help you to get out.
I would like to know if Mann ever explicitly stated his formula the way Joyce did in Stephen's essay.
Oh yes, Mann has written quite a number of papers. In fact, I don't know any author who has explicated himself more than Mann. Very few of these explications have been translated, however. There are about five volumes of Mann essays, including one very great volume that he wrote during the war, which is the key to the whole thing, called Betrachtungen eines Unpolitischen, The Observations of a Non-Political Man, a big, fat work in which the whole problematic of the Magic Mountain is presented. Now, during the writing of that work, Mann was a German of the Germans. He was on the German side emotionally and every other way in the First World War. When those ideas come out in the Magic Mountain, after Germany had been smashed and lost the war, they come out in a perfect balance. Then, as the later decades follow, Mann emotionally and every other way went over to the other side. That book will never be translated. Just for that reason. It's the Mann nobody would like to hear about now. But it's the one that gives his position. Now, with respect both to... Now, Joyce never did what Mann did. Joyce never tipped over and became propagandistic. When you read Finnegan's Wake, you find man at his worst, as well as at his noblest. There are passages in Finnegan that are, it's appalling. And he writes them always with joy, with affirmation, as you would write of a little child whom you found tearing a kitten apart. The child didn't know what he was doing, but look what he's doing, the dear little thing. And so man. With all the horrendous things he does to himself and to his neighbors. The hell of the world is man operating on himself, you might say. But that's the heaven of the world, too. That's all there is. That's where the joy is. There's a wonderful word in the introduction to Gottfried von Strasbourg's Tristan, which I hope to talk about perhaps tomorrow, perhaps this afternoon. I'm going to see how much I can tune in on later. Where he says, I write for those whom I love. I'm giving myself this task for those whom I love, that world which I love, not the world of those who would have happiness and bliss without pain. God give that they should have their bliss, but the world of those who recognize that pain is intrinsic to joy. It is not something accidentally present, but it is the intrinsic part. It is an intrinsic part of the experience of joy and rapture. And if there were no pain, there would be no joy. And if there were no joy, there would be no pain. And there would be no life without these. And I write for those who recognize the two, and by increasing one, increase the other. And now let's see how it goes. And then he gives you his Tristan and Isolde.
Did you happen to see Grotowski's Acropolis?
No.
He's a Czech who has a repertoire company. And they went through some mythological themes that were just remarkable from the Old Testament I can't even remember all of them, but really talking about man's condition in relation to the divine. And they brought it up to the contemporary, well, through German concentration camps, and Jack wrestling with the angel. And they would do the themes in such a way that time was inconsequential, earthly time, but only revealed the essences.
Well, I'll think of the concentration camp, as I was saying to somebody last night, read Viktor Frankl. There's a man who could absorb it, did absorb it, became a revelation to him. Of course, we have the two sides of us. We have our metaphysical and we have our moral aspect. And the artist can assume the metaphysical. In his living, he will act as a man with moral judgments and so forth. This doesn't mean that Mann and Joyce were monsters, because they could absorb the monstrous in life. So you have your two aspects, and this is, of course, the agony of art, the problem of art. The artist is not living. He is fixed. And what he is showing is what lies behind what lives. Now, when you go to play tennis, you can play on only one side of the court. You're one of the two antagonists. There wouldn't be any game if there were not two people. But that, by affirming the game of tennis, you are affirming that there should be another one on the other side of the court doing everything he can to get the ball back to you and throw you out. Do you see? So it is, in this view, with life as a confrontation of opposites. There wouldn't be any life without that confrontation of opposites. And it's this ironic affirmation that is the key to the artist's position. Now, to contain this, you have to have a stress on form. You can't just slop it around. And it's that rhythm of beauty, the harmony and rhythm of beauty, that enables one to render these things so that they do not slip over into one or another of these categories here. This is the discipline to which the artist devotes himself, and it's a long, long discipline. And every day, every hour, every minute spent in the studio is a cancellation of a minute that might have been spent in life. You can't have the two. Any further remarks? Well, I have time to move ahead then to some of the matter that I was planning to talk about this afternoon, and we may see how perhaps I can push things on a bit. I was thinking of talking about, and I shall be talking about, the wasteland theme, which underlies the Magic Mountain, underlies the portrait, is the basic theme of the Ulysses, and appears also in Eliot's poem of the title, The Wasteland. What is the wasteland? The wasteland is a land where people perform tasks that they have not earned, where they simply move into roles of life that have been given to them. They profess beliefs that have been forced upon them, which they do not believe, which they do not feel. They marry people they do not love. They do things they don't believe in, just because that's what's being done, or just because that's what has to be done. And when you think of the 12th century in France and in Europe, where people were compelled to believe what many did not believe, where people were compelled to do what many did not want to do, where marriages were arranged and these young girls were practically a program of ravishment. They were married for social reasons, for political reasons, for economic reasons, and love was the terrible accident. When love came into a life, this was wreckage. People were killed for it. Love was the great sin. You have a world where people are doing what they have to do, but do not, out of their nature, move into it. In the Tonio Kruger, the young artist moved out of the world of what had to be done. In the Magic Mountain, Hans Castorp stepped away from the world of what had to be done and followed the fascination of his nature. That is the adventure. All mythologies have two sides. They can be read either as the protections of the village compound, where everyone does what the myth tells him to do. That I would call the priestly order, where the mythological forms which are supporting the society are enforced on the individuals who are thereby incorporated in the organism of the society. That's the mythology of the village, the mythology of the village compound. The adventure begins with one's dissociation from the village interpretation of the forms. And then you will have to start at the beginning. You can't take the form in its full presentation as the great culture from which you're departing has presented it. You must find it in small way in your own life, but that will be a small green plant instead of a petrifact, and out of green life comes growth, and a great bay tree may develop out of that. But it's better perhaps to have one tiny little promise of a flower than a whole forest of petrified trees. The adventure begins when you leave the village behind. Walk past the walls. Break the taboos. Go into the wilderness and the silence. The advantage of staying in the village is that no dangerous winds will blow there, except those of yourself drying up inside. As soon as you go into the forest, you are naked to whatever the winds of the spirit or the demons have to blow at you. You are in great, great danger. And it's good to adventure the adventure cautiously, but tenaciously, not rushing too fast. Let me begin by simply reviewing something of the Tristan motif. The story, as you all know, is of Tristan, who is born of a mother who dies giving birth to him, his father having already been killed in combat, in knightly combat, and so he is, as it were, the fatherless one, and he's called Tristan because of the sorrow of his death. At least that's the legend. It actually is another story which would take a half hour to tell you. It's all from a Celtic background, actually. And then this child is brought up by foster parents. This is the real normal hero life. The child brought up by foster parents who ventures to the court of King Mark after he has learned all the learning of the world, both music and languages and how to cut up animals that have been killed in the hunt and so forth. An absolutely, perfectly, completely competent youth. The glory of knighthood. He's not the one who fell down when he danced. He's an absolutely competent being. And he goes to his uncle's court in Cornwall, King Mark. And the whole court of Cornwall is in bondage to Ireland. The Irish court is sending now a person to collect the taxes, the taxes being a number of youths and maidens who are going to be taken to Ireland to be sacrificed by these Irish monsters. The battle with Mordred then takes place, Tristan offering himself as the champion of Cornwall. It's a wonderful battle out on an island, and the two knights at each other. And Mordred strikes Tristan's thigh. Now the one stricken in the thigh is a very important figure. Strikes Tristan's thigh with a poisoned sword. The poison has been made by Isolde's mother, whose name is also Isolde, and she is the mother is the sister of Mordred. Mordred says to Tristan, "You are dead. No one can save you now but my sister. Will you capitulate?" And the answer is a blow on the head from Tristan's sword, which smashes Mordred's skull, but leaves a little bit of the sword in the skull. So Cornwall is saved. Mordred's corpse is taken back to Ireland with the chink in it, and Tristan presently falls sick. He has been bitten, you might say, by that poison which the goddess alone can cure and give. Medusa, it is said, when her head was cut off, spilled forth blood from her two sides. Blood from her left side would kill, blood from her right would heal. And so it is with Isolde, so it is with love. You can die of love, or you can be elevated to heavenly rapture by it. Tristan is now in the dying stage, so to say. Then we have this marvelous scene of Tristan knowing that he can be cured only in Ireland, having himself put into a little boat, which propels itself, as the spirit does on its own adventure. Once you've been wounded by the cut, you know, of the higher energy form, your little ship will carry you there. And he is taken ashore, the lovely scene, and he pretends to be a minstrel. He's there with his harp and his wonderful gift for song. He pretends to be a minstrel, and is the reek, the stench of the poisoned gangrenous body is more than anyone can bear, but a physician does take him in hand and bring him to the queen's court to be cured. She doesn't know who it is, she doesn't know whose poison it is, but she does recognize it as something she can cure. And she asks him to play, and she invites the little Isolde in to play. And when the two see each other, they don't know that they're in love, yet their hearts do, but their consciousness cuts it down. And this is the beginning of their tragedy. They hold back what happens there. He plays the harp better than he'd ever played it in his life, just because Isolde's in the room. But she has to leave the room, as everybody does, because of the stench. And Isolde says, the older Isolde, "When we've got you cured of this, I'd like you to become the teacher of my daughter, to teach her some of these wonderful arts of yours." So he becomes the teacher of this daughter. You know what the echo is here. It's of Abelard and Heloise, a century before. And then they are completely in love. But when he's fought, but they don't admit it to themselves. These are people living in terms of their social order. This nut, Tristan, comes back to Cornwall then and says such wonderful things of Isolde that King Mark is advised by all his advisors to take her to wife. So instead of serving his own psyche with his soul girl, Tristan does the social thing. He finds a queen for his uncle, King Mark. So he has to go on a second expedition to Ireland to get her. And then we have the regular dragon battle. They mustn't know who he is. He goes with his name reversed, namely Tromtrist. And he gives battle to the dragon. And to show that he was the winner, that he was the one who had overthrown the dragon, he takes the dragon's tongue from the dragon, puts it in his shirt, and the tongue is full of that same dragon poison, and it knocks him out. So a very interesting episode. There is, of course, a menial sort of prime minister in the court who wants Isolde very much. Every time anyone ever went to kill that dragon, he would stand in the background so that when the dragon had been killed, he could claim it. Well, he came to claim this dragon after he'd heard the noise of it being killed. He couldn't find the one who had killed it, but he did find the dragon dead. He took the dragon's head to court and claimed Isolde. Well, Isolde's mother knew that this fellow had never killed a dragon, but that somebody else had. And so she goes to look around, and they find this fellow's nose up above the water. That's all. He'd fallen into a pond. They rescue him. You get all the mythological motifs, the drowned man, the poison and all. And then she cures him. But in the course of curing him, a wonderful episode occurs. His weapons are there. He's in the bath, just as Agamemnon was when things happened to him. And the younger Isolde is fooling around with his weaponry. She thinks this is a wonderful man. She doesn't know it's the same one that was there before. She draws the sword out, and by gosh, there's a nick in it. And she and her mother go, and they find that it's the nick they had taken out of. And so she comes into him, he in the bathtub, she with this great big weapon. And she says, "So, you are Tristan." "No," he says, "I'm Tromtrist." And she says, "No, you are two men, and both of them are dead." Then he starts arguing with her, saying, "Look, you'll never get out of this jam with this other guy unless I'm around." Meanwhile, the weapon's getting heavier and heavier and heavier in her hand, and Brangain, the servant, comes in and offers reason, takes the sword away, and she cries, of course. But look what's happened. The mask has fallen, and here's the situation. He has come to claim her for King Mark. The arrangements are all made. She gets in the boat, and on the way, by mere chance, they drink the love potion. Now, there's been a good deal of discussion as to what Gottfried meant by the love potion. Was it actually a love potion, and did it start the love? Actually, obviously not. This pair has been in love for a long, long time. It's the most amusing thing to read the scholarly discussions of what that potion means. Did it inspire the love? Did it symbolize love? Well, scholars, you know, many of them missed those best days of their youth. They were in the library, and they don't know what happens when you're on a boat deck, and perhaps your elbows bump, and the whole thing that's waiting is released. And when it is released, it's very much there when there's been a lot of time and acquaintanceship to break through. So it's one of those things where it's been boy and girl, the boy and girl next door, you might say, for a long, long time with all kinds of notions, and then suddenly on the boat deck everything happened. And by that time, it's too late. She's to go to Mark, and he's in duty bound to bring her there. So it's this conflict, and this is the great medieval conflict, between love and duty. Well, this is the beginning of my talk this afternoon about the wasteland. Here we have the idea of a world of valid love rather than simply sacramentalized living together for one reason or another, which has the primacy over that other world. But in Gottfried, the two ideals are split. Now comes the problem of how can they be united, the theme of love and the theme of social, we say, order. And that's the theme of the Grail Romance, as represented by Wolfram von Eschenbach. And I wanted to say something about, I've decided to here talking to you now, that this afternoon about the medieval Grail, and then I'll come later to the other things I wanted to talk about. So I'll be talking this afternoon about the Grail romance and Grail romances. And for me, they represent for the North and Western civilization, which we inherit, the high myth, as Homer does for the great Greeks, or as the Mahabharata for the Indian world. This, I think, is the prime myth of the Western world. It turns up again in Mann, in Joyce, and in one great writer after another.